From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a moment, think of what you know about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know these days she spends a good part of the court session writing dissenting opinions. She's on that liberal wing of the court. You know she's tiny, she's quiet, she's 84, doesn't seem to be going anywhere. But did you also know she's a terrible cook and that she sleeps on the weekends? Did you know she is passionate about opera? Well, Betsy West and Julie Cohen's new documentary is about those parts of her life, too. Their film is at Sundance this year, and today on the program, we're talking about it. It's about her deliberate effort to build a legal framework for equal rights. It's also about her consuming loves, her husband Marty, and the law. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the women's rights movement took off in the early 70s, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was ready for it. But as one of her friends explains in a new documentary at Sundance this year, marching and demonstrating just wasn't her thing. Her thing was her legal skills. And so as a lawyer and then as a judge, Ginsburg began this deliberate and patient effort to create a new legal landscape to assure women were treated equally. Case by case, step by step, she built this framework. As someone puts it in the film, it was like knitting a sweater. She won 5 of her 6 cases before the Supreme Court. The journalists and filmmakers Betsy West and Julie Cohen say really Ginsburg was a legal architect of the modern women's rights movement. Today in the program, we continue our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. West and Cohen are with us to talk about their film about Justice Ginsburg. It's called RBG. Betsy West is a filmmaker, journalist, educator. She was a producer and executive for ABC News for more than 20 years. She's been an executive producer on both feature-length and short documentary films. She's joining us here in the studios of KPCW. And Betsy West, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Doug. Great to be here.
And Julie Cohen is with us, directed and produced 8 documentary films so far. Was a staff producer at NBC News for 9 years. These days, she's also an adjunct professor in the documentary program at Columbia University. And Julie, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
We'll give you some details about the screenings for the film. There are still a few a little bit later on the program. When did you first start talking with each other about this idea of making a film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Well, this is Betsy. Both Julie and I had interviewed Justice Ginsburg for previous projects, but this was before she gained a lot of fame as the so-called notorious RBG because of the blistering dissents that she issued. So about 3 years ago, we looked at each other and said, nobody really knows the real story of Justice Ginsburg. They don't know what you just so articulately described, Doug, the background, that she has an extraordinary history as the legal architect of the women's movement and that she expanded rights for women in the 1970s at a time when discrimination was just taken for granted. Thousands of laws that discriminated against women that nobody thought for any problem. Yeah. Hey, why not? So we realized that this is an important story, both her current position in life and the backstory. So that's when it started.
That's one thing to have this idea that you want to do this story about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's another thing to get a justice of the Supreme Court to get on board with a project like that. What was that part?
Yes, as you say, obviously it's not a simple matter. It's not like, hey, we're going to do like a full a full documentary about your whole life and participate and give us access. It'll be terrific. We understood that we were making a big ask and that it was going to be a fairly complex process to get her to participate. Basically, it was just exactly 3 years ago that we sent her an email asking if she might be willing to cooperate in such an endeavor.
Is that what one does, to send an email to Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Yes, basically. Although, you know, she for the most part, she does not read her own emails directly. Even, you know, everything goes through a whole phalanx of assistants and gatekeepers who decide what's worth passing on to her and what's not. We did have the advantage of each having previously interviewed her. But when you say write an email, I mean, this was an email that we crafted like very, very carefully.
Took
that
us
we went over
weeks and
weeks. We were passing drafts back and forth, and we were fairly proud of the request that we had constructed. And we waited a few days, and we basically got an email back saying, in essence, not yet. Yeah. We chose to take that as a positive sign.
At least it's not a no.
Exactly.
Right?
In the optimism that I think is necessary to make a documentary.
So we set about talking to some of her colleagues and her friends and really thinking about and doing research. What is the full story? Who is alive? Who can we talk to?
So you just moved forward.
Hopefully
we'll get her. Let's just go for it.
Let's go for this. Yeah. We didn't have backing yet. We were just doing this on our own. And then a year later, we wrote another email in which we were a little more specific. And we outlined some of the people we thought we should talk to. And we said we didn't really need to interview her right away because, you know, she's very busy, very scheduled. So could we go about just doing a story about your life? And rather quickly, we got an email back saying, well, I'm not really ready to do an interview for 2 years. But in your list, how about this person and that person and this person? So she was engaged and she was making suggestions. And then we knew, okay. She's interested.
And after we had started doing some interviews, and I think she had heard back from people that we were serious, we had done our homework, we were not asking superficial questions, we really understood the cases that she had argued, and we wanted to talk very substantively about her contributions to equal rights under law for women. So that led her to send us a list of here are, I think it was about 10 events that I'm going to be doing over the next year that might be interesting to film. So there was never exactly a yes, but there was just like incremental steps of increasing interest and cooperation.
Yeah.
And we just kept pushing forward.
You know, the thing that's great about the film, besides just the creation of this legal philosophy and framework that she comes up with and how important that was, but I loved knowing that she's a terrible sleeper, that she is a terrible cook, that she loves opera because of mercy and justice. I mean, that personal dynamic of her life is a really critical part of the story, I have to say.
Yeah, we really did want to have a complete picture of Justice Ginsburg. She's an extraordinary person, and we were lucky to have also the help of her biographers who gave us, who've been working on a definitive biography for a long time and gave us some insights about her childhood and other revelations about how serious she is.
Yeah.
And then her childhood friends, we love this, you know, they say very early on, she was magnetic, but she didn't call you up on the weekends and have girl chat. No girl chat. She was a serious person.
No small talk. That came up again and again.
No small talk. Yeah.
You mentioned interviewing her both before. What was she like to interview? I know, having heard interviews with Sandra Day O'Connor, for example, she could be maddeningly elusive. O'Connor was Justice Ginsburg that way too?
I wouldn't describe her as elusive, actually. Huh. The tricky thing about interviewing Justice Ginsburg or even conversing with her, for that matter, is she has a very unusual conversational style. She is a thinker. She is an intellectual. And when she is asked a question, she pauses and thinks about it for a number of seconds before responding. From what we've now heard from her family and her childhood friends, this has been true her entire life. So there's sort of this moment of tension when a question is asked, when there's a pause and you think, have I offended her? Was this a stupid question? Was it a wrong question? And then, you know, her closest friends will say, even when you say, how are you? She stops and thinks about it. And then the answer that comes out is so much more carefully constructed than ordinary human conversation. Almost every thought that she expresses has a beginning, a middle, and an end,
wow.
which is actually quite helpful for a filmmaker.
It really
you can,
is.
Like if she starts a thought, it's going to end, so you're going to have a point that you can make should you choose to use it in your film.
At her confirmation hearing, she described herself as a Brooklynite, born and bred.
Born and bred.
Let me play this moment. She mentioned how neither of her parents had the means to attend college, but that education was really important. They taught her to love learning. And there's this moment in the film where she's talking about her father and her mother. There are a couple of things I want to tease out to talk about. Let's play this moment from the film.
My father was from Odessa, and during his growing up years, Jews were no longer admitted to the Russian schools. Education was terribly important. My mother was loving but also very strict, making sure that I did my homework, practiced the piano, didn't stay out jumping rope too long. I loved to do the things that boys did when I was growing up. One of our favorite things was climbing garage roofs from one roof to another, leaping over.
So I noticed three things about this clip. First is that her father's life and his aspirations had been cut down because of discrimination. And I'm wondering how much of that fueled her intense sense of that. The other thing was that her mother taught her important lessons. We'll get back to that in a moment. But also how she loved to kind of get in there with the boys. Like that, too.
Yeah. I mean, she is a very adventuresome person, and we loved it when she said that thing about jumping from garage roof to garage roof, because later on in her life, she was known to go parasailing and whitewater rafting, and she rides horses. So she is a physically active person.
Mm-hmm.
But I think on the question of her parents, she had a sister who died before she was even aware of her sister. I mean, when she was a toddler, her sister passed away. And that cast quite a pall on the household. Her father, we were told, was depressed by that. Her mother's reaction was to push forward and to do everything she could to make sure that her remaining girl had a fighting chance in life. So her mother really did push her to go to the library, to read. And she gave her the lessons. I mean, I don't know if you pulled that clip, but
yeah,
her mother.
I did.
Yeah.
Let me play this.
Yeah, play that.
This
maybe
is,
you want to.
This
yeah.
is great because I think that in some ways you see her behavior on the court, like being deliberate and careful. Even the advice that she gives her granddaughter now seems to have come from these lessons that she learned from her mother.
Yeah, from her mother.
Yeah, here's another moment.
She had two lessons that she repeated over and over. Be a lady and be independent. Be a lady meant don't allow yourself to be overcome by useless emotions like anger. And by independent, she meant it would be fine if you met Prince Charming and lived happily ever after. But be able to fend for yourself.
In my lifetime, I expect to see 3, 4, perhaps even more women on the high court bench, women not shaped from the same mold, but of different complexions.
That last little moment I had to throw in because there's this great scene. This is at our confirmation hearing, and
yes.
they're panning all of these men. And these old men like Strom Thurmond, and it's kind of a powerful image, I have to say.
Yeah.
And we see that a couple of times in the film.
Yeah, yeah. The confirmation hearings in 1993, when she was nominated to the Supreme Court by Bill Clinton, provide a kind of spine for the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
We come back to these hearings because she really did talk extensively about her life and her judicial philosophy.
So back to the idea of the lessons from her mother. It seems important to understand her legal strategy. in some ways was based on that. Like, don't get overcome by these useless emotions. You need to plow forward. And that seems to have really impacted her.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that's pretty incredible, keep in mind, you know, Ruth Bader at the time's mother died when she was 17 years old. So she was really listening to the lessons of her mother from everything that we know from her and everyone close to her. She and her mother were just extremely close. And those lessons and the reason we included her talking about them in the film really set a course for both her personal life and in particular her kind of career and legal strategy. Like, she faced a lot of discrimination throughout her early career. She graduates, you know, top of the class of Columbia Law School. She goes out into the working world and can't get a job at top New York law firms. Not like she's even in the running, really, because they're like, no, we don't hire women. Or there was one case where a firm said, like, oh, yeah, we once hired a woman and it, like, didn't work out so well, so we're not going to be doing that again, you know, for 50% of the population.
Right.
certainly, that would be a situation where certain useless emotions like anger might be provoked. You could just give up. But she always thought back, like, no, my mother told me, don't let that stuff weigh you down. Think how you can move forward. And also, don't be sitting around planning to rely on a man. It's great to have a lovely Prince Charming in your life. And actually, as we'll get to,
she did
have a great Prince Charming in your life, as it turned out.
Yeah.
But it's important for a woman to fend for herself. It seems like maybe a more obvious lesson now, but at the time that her mother was saying those lessons, which was in the 1940s, it was actually quite an unusual position for a woman to take. So her mother was actually quite forward-thinking, too, in her day. And the fact that young Ruth listened so closely really set her on a very positive course for the rest of her life and career. I think it's still relevant to who she is now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Prince Charming, Marty, because this is so much a love story in some ways. Let me play another moment from the film. Maybe you can mention where they met, because that's a kind of a lovely moment.
They were both undergraduates at Cornell University, and she has said many times that Marty – because, well, first of all, let me say this. Ruth Bader was a very beautiful woman.
She really was.
Really beautiful. And I think you see that in the stills and the home movies that we were lucky enough to get. And so it's very poignant when she says that Marty was the first boy who was interested in me for my brains.
Yeah.
He noticed.
Yeah. So we'll hear that in this moment. We'll also, by the way, hear from the NYU law professor, Arthur Miller, who's in the film. He's quite great, too.
He was the first boy I ever knew who cared that I had a brain. Most guys in the 50s didn't. One of the sadnesses about the brilliant girls who attended Cornell is that they kind of suppressed how smart they were. But Marty was so confident of his own ability, so comfortable with himself, that he never regarded me as any kind of a threat.
We all were struck by the tremendous difference between Marty and Ruth. Marty was the most gregarious, outgoing life of the party. Ruth was really quite recessive in a way. Shy, quiet, soft voice. But they worked. They worked.
Man, they really did.
Yeah.
I have to say, there are these moments when you're showing her these clips of Marty when they were young, when they were, dating. They were great stuff, and she's just delighted by it.
Yeah. I mean, Marty Ginsburg died in 2010, and obviously a great sadness for Justice Ginsburg. But when you talk to her about him, she's so happy to talk about him. She says she had the most wonderful 56 years. She loves to talk about Marty. I mean, that's actually a trick that people who interview her use. They wait until, because, you know, when you go to the Supreme Court, they give you a limit of time that you can talk. It's good to wait to the end and ask about Marty because she loves to talk about him.
a trick that people use, Betsy says. In fact, we ourselves included.
Yes, you did it too.
Perhaps, because once you bring up Marty, like no matter what the time constraints might be, she does want to keep talking because there's nothing that delights her more than talking about him as a human being and the magical relationship that the two of them had.
That's Julie Cohen, along with Betsy West. They directed and produced RBG, which still has two screenings as part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. Tonight at 6, it's going to screen at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. Then on Saturday night at 8:45, it's going to be at the Park Avenue Theater here in Park City. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course. In their new documentary film, Betsy West and Julie Cohen explain how Ginsburg became this phenomenon. They tell the story of how her resolute drive to use the law helped give equal rights to women. It's also a pretty great love story, too. We're broadcasting from the studios of KPCW in Park City, and they're joining us here in the studio. We'll mention, by the way, some of the there are a few more screenings left, and we'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. So she gets married. She's pretty young, 21, I guess it was. This was in 1954, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, not so young back then.
Yeah, of course.
You know, if you graduated college not having been married, you were considered an old maid.
She says something in the film. I want to play this moment. She balances being a mother with having a legal profession and how being a mother, just let's keep this in mind. And she says this in this clip. She's in law school with a 14-month-old baby, but that provides some grounding for her or something like that. Here's another moment from the film.
It turned out that I did very well the first year, and I attributed to having something very important in my life that wasn't the law books. I came to Harvard as the mother of a 14-month-old child. I'd go to school, study as hard as I can in a very concentrated way. I didn't waste any time. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, our babysitter left, and that was my child's hours till she went to sleep. Playing with my daughter gave me a respite from the kind of work I was doing at law school, and I think made me more sane.
This was such a fascinating insight into her life, because I think on some way, there was part of me that wondered if she, maybe it was just Marty who did all the parenting, but that
he was in law school, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you really do. When I first heard her say this, it was like, really? You had a toddler and that was helping you at law school? But this is really her attitude of just pushing forward. When she got pregnant and she knew that she was going to be going to Harvard Law School, she was a little upset. Hmm. And her father-in-law said to her, look, Ruth, no one will blame you if you decide that you don't want to go to law school. But if you're going to go to law school, just you'll find a way. And that is her attitude. Just find a way. Whenever she meets an obstacle, she figures out how to make it work for her.
Well, would you just mention how crazy intense her schedule was at that time, taking care of a sick husband, or her husband gets cancer? And it just seemed exhausting. This moment.
Right. I mean, she's in Harvard Law School, one of 9 women in a class of 500. Already that's one of the most stressful places to be under any circumstances. On top of that, she's doing so well that she's made the law review, which is not easy to do by any stretch. Then her husband gets testicular cancer. She's also raising her toddler baby. She ends up in a situation where her husband can't go to classes because he's too ill. He's having radiation treatments and I believe has had surgery at that point. And she's going to her classes. She's going to his classes and taking notes. She's coordinating friends of his to help be part of this group effort to kind of get him through the process. The amazing thing is that in retrospect, she's viewing this whole experience as having been kind of a net positive, a time when she pushed through. And when they managed to, you know, he did graduate from Harvard Law School, which is why she ended up shifting over when he got a job in New York to Columbia Law School. Right. They muddled through.
Is this the point when she develops this, or maybe she's always been this way, but what, she never sleeps?
Well, she does sleep. She sleeps on the weekends.
On the weekends, right.
She catches up, as her daughter says. Yeah. I mean, she does keep a grueling schedule. Both her kids talk about getting up in the middle of the night, seeing mom at the dining room table with her legal pads, writing into the early hours. Then she has to get up relatively early, although she is a night owl.
Yeah.
We've seen this. I mean, we were filming with her in Santa Fe at the opera, where she and her family go every year to the Santa Fe Opera. It's a family vacation. And they had their one night. Operas are generally very long, but one night there was an early opera. It was over at 9:30. And one of the U.S. Marshals, who's always with her, said, I said to him, "Oh, you're going to have an early night." He said, "No, Justice Ginsburg wants to go out to dinner after the opera." So she's a night owl. She really, that's who she is.
She graduates from Columbia, as you mentioned, in 1959, and no one is willing to hire her. And this is where the film really starts to break down this legal philosophy that comes to her mind. You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but there were, as the film points out, thousands of laws at that time on the books that discriminated on the basis of gender. And you kind of go through this litany about what they were like. Would you just talk about the context of that time?
The context was, as you say, a period where the idea that women and men should be equal in law, it's not just that that idea wasn't accepted, it's that it hadn't occurred to a lot of people. So as a result, there were laws that said that a woman couldn't get a line of credit or take out a mortgage on a home without her husband co-signing, that a woman just had very – a married woman had very few rights vis-a-vis, you know, in 12 states. If a husband raped his wife, there was no avenue to prosecute that. You know, it was just a landscape that, you know, young people today are not aware existed only a few short decades ago and was quite accepted and often viewed as, oh, but we're – you know, women are treated in a special way. We open doors for them. They're on a pedestal. So she had a lot of educating to do.
Yeah, I mean, women didn't have to serve on juries in a lot of states. That was optional. Well, you could say, oh, that's a nice thing for women. Well, it's not so nice for the defendants, including, you know, one defendant who was on charge of murdering her husband who'd been battering her. And, you know, the jury is all men. So it never occurred to people that there was a problem with this.
And this becomes her entree into becoming a litigator on these cases. And this is where she starts developing this legal framework. Let me play a moment from the film. Brenda Feegan is in the film along with Nina Totenberg. People, at least in public radio, will recognize that. Just talking about her philosophy to try to create, what is it? Good law, I think, as it's put.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
At that point in time, Ruth was developing her philosophy to take cases that would make good law. If the case is going to be on its way to the Supreme Court, we wanted to be involved and we wanted to, frankly, take over the case.
She was following in the footsteps of the great civil rights lawyer Thurgood Marshall, who was the architect of the battle for racial equality, basing it on the clause of the Constitution that guarantees equal protection of the law. She wanted it to apply to equal protection for women.
One of the great things about the film is that you take these cases, these really important ones, that she's arguing before the court, and you break some of them down. Frontiero versus Richardson from 1973 is the first one.
Yeah, I mean, we were so lucky that to be able to interview Sharon Frontiero, who 45 years ago, was in the Air Force and discovered that her married male colleagues were getting housing benefits that she was not getting. She was married. And she thought, oh, there's a mistake. I'm going to get this mistake fixed. And then was told, no, this is a deliberate policy. Then she thought, well, I can just get a lawyer to write a letter and they'll fix that. And realized that she was in a constitutional battle.
Yeah.
And she is one feisty gal.
She's so great in the film.
Isn't she great?
Yeah.
And we were so lucky to be able to bring her story alive.
Which you do in a couple of these cases, too.
Yeah. You know, as you say, it was a step-by-step process. Justice then Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the lawyer, was thinking very deliberately about how far she could take the law. And so the next case that we highlight is the case of a man, Stephen Weisenfeld. He's a widower. He's trying to take care of his young baby because his wife has died in childbirth. And he finds out that he doesn't get the same Social Security benefits that he would get if he were a woman. And that's a very appealing case to bring before 9 male Supreme Court justices. They can see that, hey, a man is being discriminated against here. So she was very careful about the cases that she brought.
Let me play another moment with Brenda Segan, because I love this part of the film where you talk about how she's writing the brief. This was in the Frontiero case. And she and Brenda are writing this out, working this out, how careful she is to lay this case out. But also, we hear that moment in the end, and I want to talk to you about that, how she throws in stories from history. Like, that seems a really important tactic of hers, and it's really interesting. Here's another moment from the film. This is Brenda Feagan.
Ruth and I set to work to write the brief. I would write a section, and Ruth would take it, and it would come back in a wonderfully brilliant fashion. Every word was carefully. I mean, Ruth went over every single word. What we wanted was a review of cases that the court would say sex discrimination doesn't work. And it would be a broad command, basically, to legislatures to get rid of statutes that discriminate on the basis of gender. But she also added, to make the point much more poignant, the history of women and the way we were treated throughout America and its beginnings.
There are a number of moments in the film where she refers to history, trying to get these men to figure out what it was like to live, I think, as it's put in the film, like a second-class citizen.
Yes. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yes, she's a lawyer, but she also saw herself and still sees herself as an educator. The way she humorously puts it in one section of film where she was first approaching these male justices in the 70s was that she actually saw herself more as a kindergarten teacher,
right.
Because her audience had so little idea what she was talking about. But she very effectively thought she could make the case, rather than just talking about one little policy in the Air Force where the housing benefits weren't equivalent for married men and married women, to like, actually, there's a bigger context to all this. We've got a history in our country where a woman just doesn't feel like a full citizen. And in fact, under the law at that point, she was not a full citizen. She wasn't given the same protections under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment that a man would. And, to make the case and to really bring it home for the justices, she decided to do what any great educator or even storyteller does, of let's kind of broaden this out and show how women have been impacted over the decades and even centuries by kind of systemic discrimination. It was kind of a big, bold strategy to take, to go so broad, but she just did it. And that's why, as she and other lawyers and people that were in the room recall, the justices, who normally interrupt almost every sentence with questions during a Supreme Court argument, were essentially stunned into silence. And through her whole 10-minute the whole 10-minute section of her argument, they just sat there staring at her. And she then says to us, I was thinking to myself, like, are they not absorbing this at all? Or am I telling them something that they haven't heard before? And are they paying attention?
Yeah. Here's another moment from Brenda Feagan.
The justices were just glued to her. I don't think they were expecting to have to deal with something as powerful as a sheer force of her argument that was just all-encompassing. And they were there to talk about a little statute in the government code. I mean, it was just, we seized the moment to change American society.
In asking the court to declare sex a suspect criterion, we urge a position forcibly stated in 1837 by Sarah Grimke, noted abolitionist and advocate of equal rights for men and women. she said, I ask no favor for my sex.
All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
I have to say, one of the things that is so great about the film is hearing her in front of the court, not as a justice, but arguing her cases as a lawyer. Would you talk a little bit about that? We can play there are a couple of exchanges here where she pushes back from Potter Stewart in one particular case, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, there are no cameras in the Supreme Court, but we're extremely lucky that the Supreme Court does audiotape all of the arguments. So we wanted you people to hear as much as possible of the young Ruth Bader Ginsburg. At first, she sounds a little tentative, and then she gets stronger and stronger. And then also, she has to be quick on her feet to deal with some of the comments from the justices that, in retrospect, you can't quite believe they said that.
Female citizens of Louisiana are denied equal protection by the total absence of their peers from the jury.
I thought new theory was that there's very little difference between men and women, and so why wouldn't the men jury be their
peers? Well, I'm not aware of that new theory.
They didn't get it. They didn't understand the issues that women were facing, or they didn't see them as issues. Because women had, in their minds, women had a place, and it wasn't where Ruth Ginsburg was suggesting that it ought to be.
Men and women are persons of equal dignity, and they should count equally before the law.
You won't settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar.
When they would say things like this, how did you respond?
Well, never in anger, as my mother told me. That would have been self-defeating. Always as an opportunity to teach. I did see myself as kind of a kindergarten teacher in those days because the judges didn't think sex discrimination existed. Well, one of the things I tried to plant in their minds was, think about how you would like the world to be for your daughters and granddaughters.
I should point out, we also heard from Harry Edwards there.
Judge Harry Edwards actually was a suggestion from Justice Ginsburg, yes, that we should definitely interview Judge Harry Edwards, who is fantastic in the film.
Yeah, he really is.
Yeah.
Can we talk about opera for a minute? It just seems so important to her. And one of the things that she says, she speaks so passionately about it. She says the sound of the human voice is like an electric current going right through her.
Yeah. It's such an important part of her life. Music is such an important part of her life. And she is a super fan of opera. She knows a lot about opera. And she seemed, when she was watching the film, and she had not seen the film before the screening on Sunday, Julie and I were sitting sort of catty corner across the aisle. And when it came to the opera section, she was dabbing her eyes a little bit. It's really emotional for her. It is a release. She just loves music.
And she talked about how she learns lessons about mercy and justice in some way from some of those stories.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the great stories of opera are very, you know, archetypal stories of right and wrong and fighting back. And, I mean, I don't think it's actually too far of a stretch on her part. I mean, there is a connection. At the same time, she views going to the opera as a real escape. She is so absorbed in her work. Even when you spend time with her, you can kind of feel, sometimes you feel that actually she's thinking about cases. She's probably, in her head, she's rewriting a dissent. Is she really thinking about anything that's going on around her? The big exception to that is when she's in the opera, where she just allows herself to be completely overwhelmed and immersed in the passion of the story and the beauty of the music. And it's kind of like the only rest that she gets from her mind constantly working on the legal issues that consume her. So I think that's part of the joy, but it's certain things. It's just amazing the emotional reaction that seems to come forth from her. Talking about her husband is one of them, but also just, the story of an opera, her her level of knowledge about every opera and almost, you know, every performance of her favorite opera over the decades is stunning.
That's Julie Cohen. She and Betsy West directed and produced RBG. It's part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. Tonight at 6, it's going to screen at the Tower in Salt Lake. Then on Saturday night, it's going to be at the Park Avenue Theater in Park City. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Betsy West and Julie Cohen. We're talking about their film, which is here at the Sundance Film Festival this year. It's about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's called RBG. So she was nominated by President Clinton for the court. One of the stories you tell in here is that her husband, Marty, really drove a lot of this. She's not good at tooting her own horn, as is expressed by Arthur Miller so greatly in the film. So Marty jumped in.
Yeah. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was 60 years old at the time that Bill Clinton was looking to make his first Supreme Court appointment. He had originally wanted New York Governor Cuomo. Cuomo didn't want to do it, so he started looking around. Meanwhile, Marty, who was a very successful tax lawyer and just a very gregarious, likable guy, had a lot of contacts, had been floating his wife's name to people because he believed so strongly that she was a giant in the legal profession and that she deserved to be at least considered. Now, Bill Clinton says to us, other people were lobbying too.
Right.
And ultimately, the decision was made after Bill Clinton and Ruth Bader Ginsburg met in the White House and spent a very legal, geeky...
Two wonks, I'm guessing, right?
Hour or so talking about legal issues. And he was really taken with her and decided on the spot, okay, I'm nominating her.
He said it in, he says in the film that after 15 minutes he knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think they were talking about? What was it? Do you have any idea? I mean, as you say, they kind of were geeking out on the law, but something told him that she was right for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were just he decided she was right for it, and then they continued to talk for another, I think, hour or so on constitutional issues. I mean, remember, these are both people who have been constitutional law professors at this point. I actually do think some of the specifics of reproductive rights and how that applied to constitutional law, I think he mentioned, came up in that conversation. But the point of the conversation wasn't really to determine any more her fitness to be a Supreme Court justice. It was just the enjoyment that they both had of delving into these big issues of constitutional law that lawyers and law professors enjoy
like
dissecting
to talk about.
So much.
Yeah, right. I have to say, one of the most striking things about the film is going back to 1993 and those confirmation hearings and hearing a couple of things that were fascinating when you contrast them to what's going on today. You had a nominee who was actually talking about issues, who was actually expressing opinions about things. You had lawmakers, Senator Orrin Hatch in this particular case, talking about how he may not agree, but she seemed pretty good to me and willing to vote for her and acknowledge the differences, but, you know, those kinds of things. Here's a moment from her confirmation hearing where she's talking about, passionately too, we should say, about abortion rights. Keep in mind, this is at a Senate confirmation hearing. I don't think this is something you'd hear anymore today.
It is essential to woman's equality with man that her choice, that she be the decision maker. This is something central to a woman's life, to her dignity, and when government controls that decision for her, she is being treated as less than a fully adult human responsible for her own choices.
She was put on the court by a liberal president as a liberal justice. And that's the way this country works.
I disagree with you on a number of things, and I'm sure you disagree with me, but that isn't the issue, is it? And frankly, I admire you. You've earned the right, in my opinion, to be on the Supreme Court.
What do you want to say about that contrast today? Because that's pretty striking, I think, for people.
Yeah, it is very striking to the attitude we have today. I mean, one other thing that's kind of interesting to me, certainly there are people on the far right who hate Justice Ginsburg, but it's interesting.
Can I just say something about those first clips at the beginning of the film where they call her a witch and wicked and evil? Just point that out. That's pretty striking. Anyways, keep going.
Yeah, there are people who have those views. But in fact, many, many conservatives really admire Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's hard to get people to say negative things about her. And certainly Orrin Hatch admires her tremendously, admires her legal brain, and has said, I think it's good for the court to have a super smart liberal on the court. Maybe that's because he knew he was going to step down that he said that. I don't know. Because that's not the kind of remark that we hear in these partisan times.
You know, people who've studied the intentions of the founding fathers and the Constitution might think, like, that's really what this is supposed to be all about. Like, a government that respects differences and that allows, you know, if you're supremely qualified to be a Supreme Court justice, you should get that job. And it's not so much about the politics, but you'd be voted out of office by your conservative constituents for having that view today. And you know, since Senator Hatch isn't running again, we won't have the opportunity to hear whether his comments to us in favor of Justice Ginsburg hurt his political prospects. But again, just hard to imagine that conversation playing out in 2018 the way it did in 1993.
So we're running out of time. I'll just make note of the fact that the film really talks about the kind of arc of her career on the Supreme Court. And this may surprise some people that she did not begin on the left side of the court. It's funny. She was in the center almost with Kennedy. You had Blackmun, Souter, Stevens, further left than she was.
Yeah. She really began as much more of a moderate. And she wants to find consensus. That's what she's trying to do. And as the court turned right, as justices were replaced by more conservative justices, then she found herself in a position where she became the great dissenter. Yeah. But that's not what she wanted to do at all. As she says, I want to write in the affirmative, but if I have to, I will issue a dissent.
You mentioned her husband who died in 2010. She's so in control of herself and so in control of her emotions, it seems, and that's one of their characteristics for sure. But if she did break it all, there's a moment where she reads a letter, and I wanted to play some of this if it's okay. Would you set this up for us and talk a little bit about this moment?
So Marty Ginsburg, who had been sick when he was at Harvard Law School, but he had a second cancer that came back, and he was slowly fading and undergoing a lot of procedures, and I think had come to the point where he was recognizing what was happening here. As your good friend Nina Totenberg says, Justice Ginsburg was a little bit in denial, as people are in denial when this kind of situation is happening. This is a letter that she found on his hospital bedside addressed to her. And she read the letter, actually, in an audio interview to Nina Totenberg, who was kind of astounded that she, in fact, did crack, because Justice Ginsburg's generally pretty steely. You'll hear.
My dearest Ruth, you are the only person I have loved in my life. Setting aside a bit parents and kids and their kids. What a treat it has been to watch you progress to the very top of the legal world. I have admired and loved you almost since the day we first met at Cornell, some 56 years ago. The time has come for me to take leave of life, because the loss of quality now simply overwhelms. I hope you will support where I come out, but I understand you may not. I will not love you a jot less.
I think a lot of people would have thought that because they were so close, that after he died, she might be ready to hang it up. But talking to her as you have, that does not seem to be.
Yeah, I mean, with my response to that would be like, au contraire.
Exactly.
I think you're right. I think that would be a natural assumption. And for whatever reason, possibly dating back to her whole lifetime of determination and pushing forward when there's adversity, her response to her beloved husband's death was, if anything, to come out more energetically on a whole number of fronts, to throw herself into her work, to throw herself into public speaking. In some ways, she took on the gregarious role that had been more his role in their relationship, where she was the shy one who tended to be more quiet in public. She started speaking out more. Her public sense of humor started to come out a little bit more. The public affection for her as the notorious RBG, the great dissenter, pushed forward more, and she decided to embrace it. Her very, the sort of legendariness of her exercise routine pushed forth. Like, every element of her personality kind of amped up rather than retreating, which in a way echoes back to decisions she's made throughout her life. Hard things happen. She pushes forward.
Julie Cohen, along with Betsy West, they directed and produced RBG, which is two screenings left as part of the Sundance Film Festival. There's one this evening at 6 at the Tower Theater in Salt Lake City. And then on Saturday night, there's going to be one at the Park Avenue Theater in Park City. You can get links and information on our website, radiowest.org. Betsy West and Julie Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Great conversation. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Renee Bodley, Bob Hendricks, Scott Matthews of the radio station KPCW here in Park City. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.